Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 30th. I'm Belinda Rhodes. In the Guardian Daily today, amid further market turmoil after the US House of Representatives' rejection of Bush's bailout deal, what now for the plan itself and the election campaign? As the banking crisis begins to ripple across Europe, British consumers can take a little comfort in the Bradford and Bingley deal.
The Bradford and Bingley deal should be good news for consumers because it shows that the government will stand behind all savings deposits in a big bank.
And the shortlisted artists for the Turner Prize provide some troubling scenarios for gallery goers.
So it's a bit of a rough ride, the Turner Prize show this year. It runs a sort of emotional and intellectual gamut.
That's all coming up, but first the news headlines and a review of the papers with Sandy Wall.
The world's financial markets have slumped again after the US Congress rejected a bailout plan for supporting their banks. The lower house voted against the scheme for a $700 billion plan to underwrite or buy up the so-called toxic debt held by banks in subprime mortgages, many of which may never be repaid. This was after leaders of both main parties had spent all weekend working with the White House team, led by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, to reach a compromise, which it was thought all sides could support. The US stock market index, the Dow Jones, fell up to 7%, and $1 trillion was wiped off share values. After that, the Asian stock market slumped by up to 5% from Japan to Australia. The Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was so concerned, he urged US politicians to try again to reach a deal. The British stock market had already fallen more than 5% after the nationalisation of another bank, Bradford and Bingley. It's expected to fall further again after the US news. The Prime Minister Gordon Brown said the news from Washington was very disappointing, and he insisted the Bank of England and the government would do whatever was necessary to retain stability in Britain. David Cameron, the Tory leader, said at his party conference in Birmingham, Britain should learn lessons from the USA and realise that what was needed was for political parties to work together to get through the crisis. Well, the headlines of the papers all tell the story. The Sun calls it Blackest Monday and that the world holds its breath. The Mail and the Express speak of meltdown. The Times shows a big picture of the White House under the title The Eye of the Storm. And the Independent simply screams, sell, sell, sell. The Guardian and the Financial Times try to explain what's happening, with the FT saying simply that the house shocks investors, and the Guardian that panic grips the world's markets. The paper's financial editor goes further and writes that it was a bad plan, but it was a plan. Congress rejection takes us into new territory. Congress has now gone into recess for the Jewish holiday of New Year, so it'll not meet again until Thursday. In the meantime, the Treasury Secretary at the centre of the story, Henry Paulson, says that's no reason for him to stop work.
We have significant tools in our toolkit, but they're not sufficient. And so we're going to continue to work with what we have until we get from Congress what we need. Thank you very much.
That was Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson speaking outside the White House after the US House of Representatives turned down the $700 billion plan to rescue the economy. The bill was rejected by 228 votes to 205 in Congress, and around two-thirds of those refusing to back the bailout were Republicans. Here's their Congressman, Jim Boner.
Americans are angry, and so are my colleagues. They don't want to vote for a bill like this. And I understand that. But I have concerns about what this means for the American people, what it means for our economy, and what it means for people's jobs. I think that we need to renew our efforts to find a solution that Congress can support. And at the end of the day, this is not about Democrats or Republicans. It's about our economy and what's best for the American people.
Congressman Jim Boner. Now, from our Washington office, The Guardian's Eleanor Shaw reports on an extraordinary 24 hours, both politically and economically, in America.
What you saw was the single largest drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average in history. The U.S. stock market is now lower than it was when George Bush took office. And all of this is because the House of Representatives, the lower part of our Congress, voted down the $700 billion financial bailout package. What happened was you saw a lot fewer Republicans back the bill than anyone assumed. Even most Republicans were shocked by how many conservatives failed to support it. Democrats, you saw a lot of defectors, yes, but a substantial majority went with their leaders and, incredibly, George Bush.
As you know, about a week and a half ago, the administration visited Capitol Hill and described a crisis in our financial markets and in our economy.
Republicans tripped up to the microphones after this vote and pointed fingers at Nancy Pelosi, who's the Democratic leader of the House, and said she made a speech that was too partisan and somehow convinced dozens of their members to suddenly turn against the bill because they felt Republicans were being blamed. Truth be told, Republicans did preside over epic deregulation, and Pelosi's speech, if you hear it, was no different than any speech given before any House vote. They were just looking for an excuse, because the truth is they could not get their members on board.
I speak to you in an hour of crisis for our nation's economy. I believe that the challenges facing our economy could have a grave impact on every American worker, small business owner, and family.
People's retirement savings are being wiped out. A lot of major companies are losing more than 60% of their value. So even though the average American can't understand a credit crisis, they understand their stock portfolio being worthless.
This crisis is a direct result of a philosophy that the people who've been running Washington for the last 8 years have been following. And they've been following it for decades.
The next step is answering the question, does the Senate vote on this bill? And that's really up to Democrats, if it'll be embarrassing for the House to see the Senate overwhelmingly approve it, which it was headed to do. The bill does not have as much problem in the Senate. They could just start totally from scratch and craft a new bill. But what I would put my money on is a package of targeted changes to the bill as written, no vote in the Senate. The problem is it's got to happen this week. Everybody says that, so stay tuned.
Eleanor Shaw reporting. And you can follow this story's impact on the markets over at guardian.co.uk/business. And for more comment and analysis on the political ramifications, head to guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. Now back to Belinda Rhodes for the British perspective and the rest of the programme.
Nervousness amongst British banks was just one effect of the nationalisation of mortgage lender Bradford & Bingley, as they feared they may eventually have to bear the losses. I asked our business editor Deborah Hargreaves for more on the impact of the B&B rescue deal.
Well, obviously the Bradford & Bingley nationalisation has been another blow to confidence in Britain's banking system. Obviously Bradford & Bingley was very weak and the government felt it could not be allowed to stumble on for much longer, so they technically made it insolvent in order to take it over and take it into national ownership. Part of that business is now being broken up, with the savings deposits going to Spanish bank Santander. The government will be taking on the mortgage arm of Bradford & Bingley.
So with these kind of difficulties showing up in Britain again, are banks now looking for more government help, like in the style of the US banking bailout?
Yes, it seems that there are some requests going round government for a US-style bailout. So far, the Treasury appears to have rebuffed all of these ideas and doesn't want to step into the market in a bigger way than it has done already. I mean, it's very difficult to see actually what governments can do now, because even in the US, the bailout has not supported the stock market and people remain very nervous. But there are all sorts of discussions within banking and government circles about what can be done and whether there is more a wider bailout needed. So far, that's not been forthcoming. But if the share prices continue to fall at this rate, then who knows?
The markets have reacted terribly to this, but can consumers be any more confident after this takeover?
Well, the markets have been very shaky, and markets are still worried about confidence in the banking system and again in the US banking bailout. So markets are very nervous. But I think the Bradford & Bingley deal should be good news for consumers, because it shows that the government will stand behind all savings deposits in a big bank. We'd only known up till now that we were protected up to £35,000 worth of our investments, and that the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, which is financed by the banks, would pay us for that, but not for any more. Now, the government has said in Bradford & Bingley it will stand behind all savings, and it's actually paying Santander, the Spanish bank that's taking over the savings deposits of Bradford & Bingley, £4 billion to compensate it for savers who aren't covered by the bank's own compensation scheme. So I think that means, as consumers, we can be confident that if we have our savings in big banks, and they are more than £35,000 that would typically be covered, we know that the government will stand behind those.
And where up to now most of the impact of the credit crunch has been concentrated in America and Britain, there are some fairly major ripples beginning to run through Europe as well now, aren't there?
Yes, it's really hit Europe. The Fortis bailout, which came late on Sunday night, has seen the Belgian-Dutch government stepping in to help that bank and to protect depositors. That has had a knock-on effect across Europe. It's led to a lot of nervousness amongst European banks. We've seen in Germany, Hypo Real Estate, the second largest real estate bank in Germany, bailed out to the tune of 25 billion euros. In Iceland, the third biggest bank, Glitnir, has been nationalised by the government, and the government has said it will protect savers' deposits. In France, the big banks have held a meeting with Sarkozy to discuss the fall in their share prices. So the ripples of this credit crunch are going further and further through Europe.
And do you think, can you see any areas that are protected, any countries that are unlikely to be affected, or is this just going to go on and on, rippling through countries on and on and on?
I think it just shows the extent of the US subprime problems. They've spread through the banking system, and even banks without subprime investments are now being infected by this loss of confidence. And banking is, after all, about confidence. Once people start to lose their confidence in the system, the whole thing is undermined and starts to crumble. I think that's what we're seeing now with these big share price falls in banks across Europe. We are seeing a wholesale loss of confidence amongst investors in our banks.
Deborah Hargreaves there. And coming up later in the programme, a pirate ship with a high-risk cargo is still surrounded off Somalia.
The small arms certainly are a big worry, and there are already reports, unconfirmed, and I stress unconfirmed, that boats have been seen leaving the MV Fina with some of the cargo. So, yeah, that is a worry.
Today at the Conservative Party conference, the talk will all be of education, violent crime and families, with former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith and Shadow School Secretary Michael Gove taking to the stage. But yesterday, not surprisingly, it was all about money, the money in our pockets and that falling out of the world markets. There was a potentially vote-winning promise to freeze council tax and plenty of criticism of Gordon Brown's handling of the economy. Over now to our team at the conference in Birmingham.
I can tell you today that the next Conservative government will freeze your council tax for at least 2 years.
Hello, this is Andrew Sparrow. I'm at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. Well, we had quite a dramatic announcement in the speech today. George Osborne saying that if a Conservative government comes to office, for the first 2 years, they will freeze council tax. They're going to do this by creating a mechanism whereby if any council can keep its council tax rise below 2.5%, the government's going to give money to them and say, here's some money to make sure you don't have to put council tax up at all. So they're working on the assumption that every council in England, and this is only a policy that applies to England, but they assume every council in England is going to want to take the money. He also, it was a wide-ranging speech in which he also sort of launched a strong attack on Brown's record. He referred to the nationalisation of Bradford and Bingley. He said the government should have known a year ago that there were problems with this. The Treasury has nationalised it. George Osborne hasn't supported this. He's saying the Bank of England should have put Bradford and Bingley into some sort of administration, which should have saved money for the taxpayer.
For a year, the government knew there was a problem at Bradford and Bingley. For a year, they could have put a solution in place. For a year, they dithered and delayed. And once again, it is the taxpayer in the last resort who is left carrying the can. And I want to say this to the city more generally. There have been terrible failures of regulation. And the people in charge for the last 10 years must bear their full share of responsibility. But in the end, the failures of the banking industry are the failures of the bankers.
That was one of the surprising aspects of the speech. There's been a lot of comment over the weekend about the extent to which the Tory party relies on city money, particularly hedge fund money, for donations. But he stood up and came out with quite strong rhetoric about the bonus culture and firms paying each other dividends. He said, look, if you're paying excessive bonuses, paying dividends when you should be using the money to bump up the balance sheets in a company, don't expect the taxpayer to bail you out. And let's hear now what The Guardian's economics editor Larry Elliott thought of the speech.
George Osborne's job today was really twofold. It was to make the Conservatives look like a party of government and to make himself look like a Chancellor of the Exchequer in waiting. And I think he did a reasonably good job. I mean, his message was pretty clear, that the economy is in one heck of a state and that the government is to blame for it, that Gordon Brown's talk of abolishing boom and bust has proved to be entirely false. The second big message was that the Conservatives are going to take years to clear up the mess and that there is no real prospect of any upfront tax cuts.
Gordon Brown told us he had ended stop-go. No more boom and bust, he promised. Well, now the boom is over and the bust has come, and the message to Gordon Brown from the British people is simple. Stop, go.
Osborne had a good passage about Brown's tendency not to learn from mistakes, his refusal to admit it when he's got things wrong, which is something people in the Labour Party will tell you about Gordon Brown as much as Tory parties. And then he said, well, maybe we could believe that Gordon Brown will change his mind. Maybe he will learn to listen, learn to admit when he's got things wrong. But this is no time for a novice.
Be in no doubt, a hard road lies ahead of us. But that hard road leads over the horizon. And over the horizon will be Britain, strong again, prosperous again, confident again, proud again. So join us on this journey, for we have work to do and a future to build. Thank you very much.
It was a speech that went down very well in the hall. Here are what some of the Tory party activists who were listening had to say about it.
It was wonderful and inspiring. Very good. I think the council tax is very important for the majority of people, and just generally giving us a positive message in very difficult times.
Brilliant. Absolutely hit the right tone. It was honest. It was responsible. Absolutely right. And we do have solutions, which I'm afraid the Labour Party never have.
A freeze on council taxes will be very welcomed by families who are fighting so hard to make ends meet with the fuel poverty. Hopefully that will help send us in the right direction.
Our team in Birmingham there, and today on the website you can hear The Guardian debate on who was the greatest living Tory. Also on the website today you can find out why Cadbury's is recalling 11 types of chocolate amidst the tainted milk scandal in China. That's at guardian.co.uk/world. Get the latest on the housing market and see how or whether prices in your area have fallen with our interactive guide. That's at guardian.co.uk/money. And at Comment is Free, Christian Wolmar says the Conservative Party's plan for a high-speed rail link is a good idea, but they'll never deliver it. And of course, there's continuing coverage of all the economic news. The seizure of a ship in the waters off Somalia is not that uncommon. There have been 24 attacks this year by pirates attempting to raise money from demanding ransom for the vessels. But the cargo of the MV Fina seized last Thursday is causing additional concern, and American warships and helicopters have been circling the ship, trying to make sure that the tanks and small arms on board do not fall into the wrong hands. John Dennis heard more on the situation from The Guardian's Zan Rice in Nairobi.
It came from the Ukraine. It was headed towards Kenya, and it was carrying military hardware, predominantly 33 Soviet-era T-72 combat tanks, as well as small armaments like rocket-propelled grenades and ammunition. Shortly before it reached Mombasa, it was still in Somali waters. It was taken by pirates on Thursday night.
And do we know what happened to it?
Well, we know three small boats approached it, effectively took the crew hostage, and are now holding the boat somewhere along Somalia's eastern coast, roughly about halfway up the country. And various international warships are tracking it, including one from the United States. But at the moment, it's still being held by the pirates, and they're asking for a $20 million ransom before the crew and cargo are released.
Armed gangs have captured 30-odd ships in that part of the world this year. I mean, these are some of the most dangerous waters in the world, aren't they?
Well, they are the most dangerous this year by volume of attacks. If you look at the way the pirates are armed, there's nowhere else in the world where this sort of thing happens. They're extremely prolific. I mean, there's been 30 ships seized, probably twice as many attempted attacks, and they've netted probably tens of millions of dollars in ransoms. I mean, ship owners invariably pay up to get the boat released.
It's particularly worrying, though, Zan, because of its cargo. And, you know, intense conflict going on the land in Somalia. You know, the thought of these all this military equipment floating about, not knowing where it's going to end up.
Well, indeed. I mean, traditionally, the pirates have shown little interest in cargo, no matter how valuable it is. I mean, they assess what the cargo is worth, and they factor that into the ransom demand. But they don't traditionally offload it and try and get rid of it. But as you say, the cargo of this ship sort of changes the dynamic. There's no doubt that they'll have little value for the tanks, whichever the warring parties in Somalia. They're too heavy, they need instruction, etc. But the small arms certainly are a big worry, and there are already reports, unconfirmed, and I stress unconfirmed, that boats have been seen leaving the MV Fina with some of the cargo. So, yeah, that is a worry.
And the pirates aren't making life easier for international agencies attempting to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Somalia.
Well, that's right. I mean, they don't seem to mind who's chartered the boat, what they've got on the boat. I mean, they've captured yachts before. It's just if the pirates can make money from a ransom, they'll take whatever they can. And traditionally, the easiest way of getting food aid, in particular, into Somalia is by sea. And generally, ships come from Mombasa and occasionally further south in South Africa. But now the charter companies won't send food aid up to the port of Mogadishu because numerous ships have already been captured by pirates in the past and they've had to pay out large sums. So now the only way the World Food Programme can send food up to Somalia is if they get an international navy to escort them. And at the moment, the Canadians are doing that job.
John Dennis talking to Zan Rice. So it's autumn in London, the time of year that the work of the four artists on the shortlist for the much-talked-about Turner Prize goes on show at the Tate Britain Gallery. This year there are three women amongst the contenders for the £25,000 prize, and their work ranges from a film of a woman smashing teacups to a mannequin sitting on a toilet. I heard more about the exhibits from The Guardian's Adrian Searle.
The most startling piece is the installation by Kathy Wilkes, which is a room-sized. You walk into the room and it's a huge emptiness in front of you, and in the distance, in the middle of the room, there is two supermarket checkouts. But before you get to them, there's a mannequin sitting on the lavatory, a naked woman with all kinds of things kind of draped from her head, including horseshoes and a seashell and burnt bits of wood. And one of her eyes is covered over by a deflated red balloon. And another mannequin stands as though she were picking up her shopping, really, at one of the checkouts. Full size, these things that have just been kind of dumped in the middle of the gallery. And she's got a birdcage on her head. This is all fairly typical from Kathy Wilkes, in a way, these kind of slightly wretched and traumatized mise-en-scènes, these tableaux, which are kind of about the awfulness of everyday life, I think. And you can't really tell whether the objects in them are symbolic or whether they're just kind of messy objects. There's all sorts of bits of food and bowls laying all over the checkout counters, as if, you know, someone has started eating while they're passing their thing, you know, through checkout. And all the spoons face the same way, that are sitting in these bowls and empty jars of food. And there's all sorts of other stuff laying around, but it's as if you've walked into a nightmare, really.
Okay, so Kathy Wilkes is one of the four shortlisted. What else is there?
Okay, well, the first artist one sees is an artist called Goshka Makuga, who frequently works with other people's art. And she's shown at the Tate before, and where she's trawled through the Tate's archives to and brought up all kinds of objects and bits of ephemera, letters and photographs that deal with art movements and individuals from the past. The Tate has a great paper archive, as well as its holdings in contemporary art, and, you know, as well as its collection. And in this case, in her installation, she has got photographs of the British modernist and surrealist artists Paul Nash and Eileen Agar, who throughout the 1930s and into the 40s were lovers. And she'd kind of collaged together copies of photographs and surrealist little images by both these artists to make new images. And these are shown alongside some rather severe and strange sculptures of tinted glass and steel rails, which are in fact by a woman called Lili Reich, who was the lover and collaborator with Mies van der Rohe, the modernist architect in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. And these are all shown together, the collages on the wall and the sculptures on the floor. And also on the wall, it's a drawing that covers all four sides of the room, and it's a drawing of rain. The room is full of this thin, pencilled rain, which is extremely beautiful and really rather sad. And the whole effect is one of lost love and of, love gone bad, relationships soured, and of the absence of these figures, who are now all dead, of course. So it's a bit of a ride, a rough ride, the Turner Prize show this year. It runs a sort of emotional and intellectual gamut. Runa Islam, a filmmaker, has three very different installations of her films, one of which shows an actress smashing crockery. Very nice 1950s and 60s, very dainty teacups and saucers and vases and plates are slowly edged off the corners of tables where they fall and shatter on the floor. And the protagonist, the woman who's doing this, is very po-faced as she engages in this kind of rather willful and cathartic act. I mean, it's the sort of crockery and stuff my parents used to have, and it's a great delight in watching it all be smashed to pieces. And another of her films, she returns to Dhaka, where she was born in Bangladesh, and films The Rickshaw Drivers. Her work is very, very varied. And finally, we get a lecture in Mark Leckie's installation. It's a 40-minute lecture of him talking about images and objects, and it was filmed at Tate Modern and at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. I found myself taking notes in Leckie's lecture. So he mixes up sort of ideas about language, and he's a professor in Germany, and he's lecturing and hectoring at us at the same time as we're supposed to be appreciating what he's doing as though it were art. And he's also showing films and some other objects on the wall. So it's a very varied exhibition this year.
Is it too early to say if there's any favourite to win the prize?
Well, there's always a bookie's favourite, and there's probably an artist favourite too. And for me, I would like to see either Gushka or Runa Islam win, both for the sophistication of what they do and the complexity of what they do. In a way, Runa Islam has got a longer track record, and I think really Gushka is only hitting her stride properly in this last 12 to 18 months. So either of them I'd be completely happy with. And but hey, I sort of care more about the art than I do about the winner, really. The winning is something else.
Adrian Searle there. And that's it from today's Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. The producers today were Roxanne Escobarlis and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.